BOAG World is produced by the web design agency headscape.co.uk. It's brought to you by Shopify, an e-commerce solution made by designers for designers. For more information, visit shopify.com/BOAG World. This week on BOAG World, we review the freelancing book Noded, discover a new web tool called Support Details, and Paul tells us all a story.
The podcast for all those involved in designing, developing, and running websites on a daily basis. Hello and welcome to BOAGworld.com, the podcast for all those involved in designing, developing and running websites on a daily basis. My name's Paul BOAG and I'm joined by Marcus. Hello Marcus.
Hello Paul.
How are you?
I'm alright, but I'm a bit bored of podcasting.
I feel very lonely today. It's just us. Where's our room full of people?
Yeah, I know what you mean, but kind of, yeah, I don't care really. No, I spent so long editing it the other day that I feel hungover from last week's podcast.
Well, it was
whenever it was.
It was a long time ago now. It was over a week ago, two weeks.
Yeah,
well, I don't know.
We did it on a Friday.
This comes out on a Friday,
so it'll be 2 weeks from when we. Oh, whatever.
Get used to this, people. This is how today's show's going to be.
Definitely. No, it's nice to be back. Normality is good.
Normality is good. Although I'm looking forward to South By, which is not normal. Just running away.
Yeah, that's not a podcast thing. I quite enjoy doing the podcast. It's just there's just too much work, and I just want to go and run away to South By,
which is what we're going to do.
Yeah,
in a couple of weeks.
The trouble is, I have to take this thing with me. He points at his laptop.
Yes,
where I am connected to the internet, just the same as I am
I know.
In England.
That's the trouble, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I've got to stand up in front of a lot of people, which is quite scary. Well, it's not scary. I love a big audience.
I was going to say,
because I've got an ego the size of a small planet.
But I expect you'll be a little bit, woohoo,
no,
10 minutes beforehand.
It's not that. Do you know, the only thing that worries me about it, they put me in Ballroom A. If you haven't been to South By, you'll know that's a flipping massive room, which is absolutely fine, except I'm just terrified that it won't be full up and there'll be like three people in the background
There's 11 people from Headscape, so that's a third.
You're making the assumption they'll turn up.
Yeah, assuming they get up on the Saturday morning, because you're on first. Yeah, that's a third of the front row out of, I don't know, 60 rows.
Yes, exactly. Oh, joy. But I am looking forward to that. There's also a really good app knocking around, isn't there?
Yes, even I used it.
I can't remember what it's called now.
Wrongly, to start off with.
Wrongly, yeah. Apparently, you're already at South By.
Sitby.us.
Sitby.us. Oh, yeah. That's a good... Do you know, I never worked out that actually that made sense. So you can, which if you're going to South By, definitely check that out, because you can see which of your Twitter friends are going to go to which panels, and you can see where they're sitting and stuff like that. So it's all very good and very simple and very well designed. So congratulations to whoever did that.
Oh, exciting. I just had it. Sorry to listeners for that little MSN bum-bum-bum noise, but very heavy snow here now and has been for the last 30 minutes.
Oh, you'll never get home.
I'll never get home.
Oh,
that was my lovely wife, by the way.
So there we go.
I'm going to have to turn you off, darling.
I'm sure she'll love you for that. I thought for a minute you were talking to me.
It feels like we're married. It really does.
It does sometimes.
But I'm not going to call you darling. Oh. Or dear. Or anything.
God. This is going to be a really long show. I hope people are feeling patient. Well, not a long show as in length, but it's going to feel like a long one. So, is there anything else we need to talk about before we move on to the news? Any more housekeeping other than please come to my session at South By if you're going to be there? Oh, it's a very squeaky voice.
That was your sort of Disney mouse voice, wasn't yes. it?
Yes. Although not as stupid a voice as you did about me telling a story today.
Oh, tell us a story.
I like to say the whole of the story, like, in that voice. Yeah.
Can I leave the room at that point? Yes, let's stop. We're not going in.
Yeah, let's move on to the news. So, talking of things that we should have covered in the intro section,
oops,
I've thought of something, which is we're going to start doing more of the live streaming of the shows, aren't we?
Yeah.
Which is quite interesting, I think, for people. People like the live shows. They like being able to interact with us.
What I thought was a really big success from the 200th show were the live interviews. I know we're talking about maybe not doing that on a regular thing, but the Skype interviews...
Yeah.
On a big telly.
Yeah.
Worked really, really
well. It did work really well. And I think it was really good, you know, that whole being able to kind of, yeah, there is something about live that's good. So we are going to probably be doing some more of that, but don't expect it to be tied down to a specific date and time because Marcus is not organised enough for that. I'm blaming you. Right, news.
We're going to do one from South by Southwest.
No.
A live one.
No.
Yeah, we've done it. We'll do it at 10 a.m. on Sunday, the whatever it is.
I'm not agreeing to that. Not at South By. I am going to take, however, that little new microphone thingy that plugs into my iPhone thingy, and then I'm going to record interviews as I go along. Thingy.
Yeah, okay, good.
So that'd be good. So some little bits
I really
bits
am
and
not
bobs.
Going to do anything for the whole week, am I?
And we are going to, actually, this made me... We've got quite a lot of housekeeping that I seem to have totally missed from the intro section.
It doesn't matter.
I'm going to set up a posterous blog so that everybody in Headscape can post on stuff that's going on at South By. And that'll be bits of audio, maybe bits of video, lots of text... All that kind of good stuff. So it'll be a bit of a mishmash. So like we did last year, we're going to separate it off from the main site because it gets a bit annoying when people just talk about South By the whole time. But if you are interested in it...
Yeah, I was about to say, even though we're going, we're going South By, we will try and do some kind of...
Yeah, give some kind of coverage back. Yes. Don't make that face, Marcus. You're just hoping other people will write stuff and you won't have to.
Yeah, of course they will.
So there we go. Should we actually move on to the news?
Yeah, we are recording the news section.
Oh, by the way, we get there in a minute. By the way, I have to congratulate you on the new music, Marcus.
Oh, thank you.
It is very, very nice indeed. People have been very complimentary.
My laptop keeps making sounds. Sorry. Yes, well, you know, what more did you expect, or less did you expect?
Well, people weren't as complimentary about the last one, were they?
I don't know, I can't remember.
They were quite rude about it, as I remember.
Were they?
But this one, it was very cool.
Okay, good.
Makes you want to get up and dance.
Yeah, I mean, it's I enjoyed doing it, although I'd kind of got most of that already, and then... Wednesday or Thursday, when I said, right, I'm going to do it, finish the music, and I'm going to edit the 12-hour podcast. You make these sweeping statements, don't you?
Yeah.
And I started at about 8 in the morning on the music, and I was sort of just about happy with it enough by 1:30 in the afternoon.
Right, so...
And even though I've
done
most
12-hour
podcast. I've done most of it, and then I had to edit, and it was like... And that's in 24 bits, and sort of like by 6 o'clock I was on bit 7. And it's like... I didn't want to play... That's why I'm not playing anymore.
Playing this game, this podcasting game. Yeah.
But thank you for your kind comments, people.
Yes, so that's good. And also,
keep me going for another 100 podcasts.
The other thing that's worth saying is now, of course, the shows will be released as the bite sizes
from
now on. So you'll get the whole news segment.
That's got loads of rubbish.
We need to perhaps rearrange that. In a minute, I'll go, so now the news, and that can be the beginning of the news section.
Go on, then.
So now the news. Let's move on to the news, then. So our first news story of the day is why speculative design sucks. Now, the debate over speculative design has once again raised its head, and I know we've gone over on this for ages. Yes. Okay. In case you're unfamiliar with the concept of speculative design... it's best described as a process of producing free work for a prospective client in the hopes of winning the project.
It was my most favourite talk from South by Southwest last year, again in the huge ballroom. I sat right at the back, and it was a guy, I can't even remember the name of the site, but this guy had set up this site where designers.
Oh, yes.
Could go and, you know, basically pitch for work.
Yeah.
You know, and if you had a, you needed a new logo, you'd say, I need a new logo.
And 20 designers produce you one, and you pick the one you want.
And you pick the one you want.
99 designs, wasn't it?
I can't remember. You paid them sort of, you know, 5p for the privilege.
Yeah.
And it was great because they picked the guy who was representing sort of our position on this was magically arrogant. But just wonderful. I can't remember his name. David something. But, you know, basically any argument that came from them, which were all, you know, they all sucked in my view. They're all, you know, these things. Perfect. As a business, fine. Yeah, you can do it. But don't stand up there and say that, you know, yeah, it's good for the design world. But this guy was basically just sort of, well, that's all very well. But, you know, we're professionals, don't you know? And anything, if you don't hire a professional, then you will have a substandard design, no matter what it is. Well, it's just, and he was winding the audience up brilliantly, and of course they couldn't see that he was winding them up. It was the most entertaining talk I'd seen for a long time.
Excellent.
Sorry. Yes,
so, I mean, a lot of agencies, including us, have long since rejected the idea of speculative design. However, it is still common practice. It still happens quite a lot.
Yeah.
And Andy Budd this week has laid out his argument against speculative work. And although he raises some good points, I have to say, Andy, I think you've missed the point a little bit, at least from my point of view. Because he focuses very much as the guy that you, well, no, possibly. Andy focuses very much on it being bad for the design community, which I think is somewhat, you know, is a factor, but is not the main factor. In my view, the main factor is it's bad for clients.
It's bad for everyone, Paul.
It is bad for everyone, yes. So the better argument has been put forward by one Belgium agency, right, who is currently on strike protesting against speculative work, right? And so they've actually replaced their website with the following message. It's quite long, but I've just picked out one bit. It says, pitches use up energy. Energy an agency would normally be using to provide its existing paying customers the best possible work. So the logical conclusion of the system as it stands now is that at some point you will become a victim of it yourself. The day will eventually come when your agency has to divert the creative and strategic energy you're paying for into a pitch for someone else's business.
Yeah, and to be honest, I don't have an issue with that. Yes, we do have to pitch for work. We can't just expect people, well, that is the ideal. People walk, knock on the door and say, we'd like to do work. And it does happen sometimes. But it's not the, you know, the more successful you are, usually it means the more work you take on, the more people you employ. Therefore, you will have to pitch for work.
Yeah.
Even people that know you, you know, they also know people like Andy.
Yeah.
And they'll ask us both to pitch for the job. That's
yeah,
perfectly fair enough. What I object to is doing creative work as part of that pitch. Because, and this comes back to that it's bad for the client. We're not developing something that's designed. We're designing it for the pitch, not
for the project.
Not for the its final yeah, purpose, and that's what's wrong. And when I explain that to people who are asking for speculative design work, they go, "Oh yeah."
Mm.
And normally, you win brownie points from making that argument. So, yeah.
I mean, I put it, you know, I actually say, I mean, there is a post that I've written on the subject if you want to check it out. And I say that in order to remain in business, every company needs to recover its cost of sales. This includes web designers. As speculative work is part of the sales process, they ultimately have to charge you for it. The web designer is forced to roll at the cost of that work into the project if they win. Mm. However, it's worse than that. The web designer also has to recover the cost of speculative design work done for jobs that he did not win. This means that if you choose to work with an agency that produces speculative design, you are paying for their failed sales pitches. Why should you be paying for other people's design work? So, before you make any more requests for speculative design work, if you are a website owner and listening to this, I'd encourage you to read, well, Andy's post, my post, and even that Belgium website. I think going on strike might be a bit over the top. But.
Well, the argument, going back to this, the South by Southwest talk, was like, well, you know, how does a young designer compete against, you know, big agencies who've got this wonderful portfolio that they can point back against? And they use the word portfolio, and that's what it's about. You've got to, when you're starting out, don't put your name down for these sites where you're going to try and win work. Just do work for your friends or do work for yourself.
Or a local charity or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. And then once you've got that portfolio in place, then you're in a position to be able to start going for commercial work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Totally agree. Right, let's move on from that. So I want to talk a bit about progressive enhancement. I think as web designers, we love our jargon, even though we tell our clients all the time not to include jargon on their own websites. And one of the examples is the phrase progressive enhancement. I've thrown it around a lot on the show and to be honest, provided little in the way of explanation. However, I bet a considerable number of website owners listening, and probably more than a few web professionals as well, don't really know what the term means. Paul Stanton, who does all of our news for the show, has produced a great post this week that provides an analogy that explains progressive enhancement. And he explains how progressive enhancement can be seen on video games all the time, especially on big sports titles that span various consoles. Each console has different capabilities, with an Xbox having considerably more processing power than, say, an iPhone. So you get the same title, but on these different boxes, you know.
Yeah.
I imagine there's lots of golf titles you play that are like that. No?
No.
You're not really a big game player?
Not really.
Oh, you play on the iPhone a bit, don't you, play games? You were playing pool at one stage.
Yeah, but I'm addicted to Words with Friends now.
So what's Words with Friends?
It's like Scrabble for the iPhone.
Oh, right.
Okay. It's just fantastic. But, no, I'm going to play Wii games at home.
Right.
And golf is one of those.
Actually, Wii game is a classic example of that because, I mean, you know, what was it? Force Unleashed was one game that I got. And I originally got it on the Wii, and it was great because you're swinging your lightsaber around and all the rest of it. But the graphics were a bit shit.
Mm.
So I actually swapped it and got it for the Xbox instead, which obviously you didn't have the swinging around, but you had better graphics.
Yeah.
So that's a classic example of differences across the different platforms. And Paul explains that this is very similar to progressive enhancement on the web. Each browser has different capabilities, and as web designers, we build to make the most of what each browser can do. It's the same website, it's the same game, but subtly different depending on the platform. I think it's a really good analogy, and I have to say, it's good because the majority of people can associate with video games. They've played, you know, different video games in the past. So it's a good one to use with your clients. And
my brother-in-law got a PS3 for his birthday.
What did you think?
Very nice indeed.
The good thing about PS3, of course, is it comes with Blu-ray player.
Yeah.
Which is a bonus.
Very nice bit of kit all round.
Mm. So there we go.
Compared to my son's flaky Xbox, it sounds like it's going to drill a hole through the floor.
Oh, Xboxes are so loud. Unbelievably loud.
Same.
But anyway,
moving on.
Yeah, so that was it for that story. But I do want to move on to about the idea of being different is the next story and how to be different. Some of us are naturally different, but but that's not what I'm talking about. We walk a fine line with our websites, right? On one hand, we want them to meet users' expectations and avoid making people think too hard, as in Steve Krug's book.
Simon Collison was talking about last week.
Exactly. But on the other, we want our sites to stand out from the crowd and be memorable, all right? So in a new article on the Carsonified blog, there's this article that talks about walking the line, walking exactly that line and challenging us to move away from kind of cookie-cutter designs that all look the same. So the article is a challenge both to designers who tend to get caught up in the latest trend and website owners who are often overly conservative in terms of design. So it aims to kind of inspire you with some great examples of sites that break the mold. And there are, you know, such strong trends. So all websites tend to go through these. You could almost name the year that they were built in on the basis of what they look like.
Yeah.
And it's good to break the mold and do something different. Of course, the suggestions aren't going to be relevant to every site. You need to be carefully consider your target audience in order to establish how far from the norm you can push a design. However, whatever your site, you know, I think this is a really challenging post that kind of makes you think, okay, you know, let's push it a little bit. Let's, you know, the navigation doesn't always need to be, you know, running horizontally across and down the left-hand side. The search box doesn't always need to be in the right top corner. And, you know, there are occasions when you can break some of these usability rules.
And you roll over them and then the word pops out the top. Things like that.
No.
No?
See, this is why you're not allowed to design websites.
Mystery meat navigation.
Mystery meat. Wow, that's back in the day.
That's going back some. When you had to roll over things to find the navigation.
Yeah.
But it's different.
It is different. Yeah, that's breaking the mold, all right? Okay, so the final story that there's no way I could have not mentioned that this week because it's been the hot topic is basically an interesting argument that's exploded all over Twitter and has since spilled over into the blogosphere too. And the argument was sparked by Elliot J. Stocks, bless him, who wrote on Twitter the following. I'm shocked that in 2010, I'm still coming across web designers who can't code their own designs. And it would appear that this is a somewhat controversial comment and has led to a massive backlash of designers who do not code.
I struggled to, when it came out, I mean, this, I looked at it the next day.
Yeah.
And I struggled to find anyone who was saying that. Everyone was going, well, yes, of course they should also be able to code.
Yeah, but that.
And yes, of course they should.
Yes, but don't forget that depends on who you follow. You are by definition because of Headscape and where Headscape positions itself, we're part of the web standards community, and the vast majority of designers can code within the web standards community.
Yeah,
but I don't think it's true generally speaking, especially in ad agencies type scenarios.
Yeah, where that makes sense because the designer will be far more senior than what they see as the code monkey.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is my design. Make it work.
Yes.
Kind of thing. There's nothing wrong with that. What's wrong with that?
I mean, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to inflame the debate any further. And I would have thought the majority of people that listening to this show who are designers are able to code as well. And I have to say, it just amazes me that anyone could disagree with this statement. But I know they do.
Well, what are the arguments against then?
I was going to avoid getting into this. I mean, there are three articles that have been published this week that I suggest you read, Marcus, if you want to know the arguments against this.
Well, just give us a quick synopsis. If that's the right word, I think it is.
It's difficult. I mean, one is that there's a difference between being able to code your own websites, right, and actually doing the coding. So I've got no problem, for example, like in Clear Left, where you know, Paul Annette will sometimes produce designs, or often produce designs, that are then coded up by, you know, Natalie or Jeremy. That's kind of fine because Paul is perfectly capable of building his own code if he wants to. He just chooses not to, or the way they're organized is not done that way. But I think there is a need to understand the underlying technologies and what is possible and what is not, in order to be able to produce a good design. You can often do things in a design that just isn't suited to HTML and to the limitations of the technology. And I think there's also, it's kind of indicative of a not fully understanding the medium you're working with. You know, it would be, you know, it's like, I mean, people would argue, for example, that one of the arguments that went around on Twitter is, well, the architect doesn't build the building. Do you know, that was one of the arguments. Yeah, but the architect knows what materials, you know, are used, what will work and what will not work. You know, they're not going to make a house out of jelly. You know.
Ooh, that'd be cool, though, wouldn't it?
It would be cool. Can't fancy that idea. And that's the same principle. I think you need to understand the tools that are available, understand the medium which we're working in to be effective. But, I mean, there's some great posts. Elliot J. Stocks does one, Web Designers Who Can't Code. Mike Coos has got one, Five Reasons Why Designers Should Code. Mark Bolton has written one on designers writing HTML. Check them all out. They give much more comprehensive answers than I've just given you here. I've kind of skipped over it because I don't want this to turn into the longest podcast of me shouting into the mic. But, you know, if you happen to be a designer who can't code, I would strongly recommend you read these posts. I honestly believe you're limiting your potential and undermining the products that you're ultimately providing your clients. This is a big issue. And I think if I was a website owner, there is no way on earth I would hire a company whose designers didn't understand HTML and CSS backwards. That's my opinion on it.
Yeah.
Should we move on from the news? Because I think it's time for me to tell a little story. Okay, so I thought I'd do something a bit different for the feature today. That, you know, after the highbrow stuff of the 200th episode and all those, oh no, come on, quite intensive interviews and talking about some, I'm ignoring the stuff where you were immature and childish. most of it.
Say like highbrow, I don't remember that.
It was all quite intense stuff, you know, discussing HTML3 and CSS.
Oh yeah, I suppose. I'm not saying it wasn't useful, but, you know, I mean, Jeremy was in being quite sort of, you know, educated as he is.
Well, no, he was talking about sci-fi,
yeah,
mainly.
Yeah, we were talking about sci-fi.
Exactly.
That's true. And playing his Mandarin.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I like that, saying that. Right. So I thought, let's do something a bit different, right? I've been reading a book called Made to Stick, which is all about getting ideas to stick with people and storytelling, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And about how powerful storytelling is. And things like Aesop's fables and, you know, all the kind of parables that are in the Bible and all of these kinds of different long-lasting stories. So I've written one of my own. All right?
Okay.
Once upon a time... Are you ready? You ready for this?
Yeah, I'm just looking up jokes because I'm bored already.
Once upon a time, there was a client named John. And he's come to you with a clear set of business objectives and asks you for a quote, Marcus. What happens next, unfortunately, leaves John confused, frustrated, and extremely unhappy. Before giving John his quote...
You can drop the voice now, by the way.
No, I like the voice. It's soothing.
No, it's not. It's slightly worrying.
Oh, dear. Before giving John his quote, you ask a little bit more about his project. After chatting for a few minutes, you ask him about his budget. A fair enough question, you think. After all, there are so many ways you could approach the project. Without knowing the budget, it's impossible to know where to begin. In your mind, building a website is like building a house. Without knowing the budget, you can't possibly know how many rooms the client can afford or what materials you should use to build. John, on the other hand, is instantly suspicious. Why would you want to know his budget? The only reason he can think of is that you want to know it so you don't undercharge him when there is more money available. Anyway, he doesn't really know what his budget is. How the hell is he supposed to know how much a website costs? John goes away determined to find a web designer who isn't going to screw him over. Fortunately for you, all the other designers he asks also fail to explain to him why they need to know his budget, and so you manage to win the project anyway.
I think John sounds like a dodgy client.
Why? Why?
No, I'm joking. Move on.
This is going to be a long story, I could tell.
How much more of this do I have to put up with?
There's loads of it. Oh, right. Pages of it. Once you've won the job, you arrange a kickoff meeting to nail down the final specification. I did have you in mind when I wrote all this, by the way. However, John is instantly regretting his decision to hire you as his worst fears are confirmed. In his eyes, you immediately try to squeeze out more money from him as you waffle on about the importance of usability and accessibility. John doesn't care about disabled users. No disabled users use his website anyway. As for usability, surely it is the job of the web designer to make the website usable. Why do you need expensive usability testing? He is pretty sure usability testing involves expensive things like cameras, usability labs, and two-way mirrors. Unfortunately, you believe you explain the issues clearly. You've talked about WCAG 2 and mentioned Jacob Nielsen, for crying out loud. You're beginning to wonder if John is stupid. Maybe if you talked about accessibility in terms of search engine rankings and usability testing as a way to increase conversion, then John might be interested. As it is, John puts his foot down and refuses to pay for these unnecessary extras. You go away from the kickoff meeting, pleased to have signed the contract. However, you have the feeling in the pit of your stomach that this is going to be another one of those projects. Nevertheless, you pick yourself up and dive into the design process. Almost immediately, you get a phone call from John asking if there is anything for him to see. You explain that it's still early days and that you're not ready to present at this point. John sounds disappointed but resigned. A short while later, you are ready to begin present the design to John. You are really pleased with the result. It's taken a lot more time than you budgeted for, but it was worth it. The final design is extremely easy to use and will make a great portfolio piece. When John sees the design, he's horrified. From his perspective, you've entirely missed the point. The design clashes with his offline marketing material and fails to focus on the right selling points. Also, he's convinced his suppliers will hate it. And although they are not the end user, their opinions matter. After a tense conference call, you go away demoralized, but with a compromise that will hopefully make John happy. You wonder in hindsight whether it would have been better to show John some of your initial ideas and sketches. Perhaps you should have produced some wireframes first. After much agonizing and compromise, you are once again ready to present to John. John is much happier with the new design and feels it's heading in the right direction. However, he does have some concerns. For a start, he has to scroll to see most of the content, and yet there's empty white space on either side of the design. He tells you to move key content into the wasted space. As also, he thinks that his young male target audience, Also, as he thinks about his young male target audience, he realizes that the color scheme is probably too effeminate. So he tells you to change it to blue. While John is feeling somewhat happier, you're feeling crushed. It feels like he's doing your job for you. The string of feedback about moving this and changing the color of that feels like reducing you to a pixel pusher. By this stage, you assure the client is stupid. You just want the design signed off. At no stage do you stop to ask John why he's requesting these changes. Perhaps if you'd understood his thinking, then you might have been able to explain concepts like screen resolution or suggest an alternative to the corporate blue, which is so massively overused on the web. Instead, you wash your hands of the design and just give John what he wants. Now that the design is complete, you turn your attention to the site build. At least John won't care about your code. Now you can finally do things right. It's a big job and it takes a lot of time. Even though you put too much time into the design and then wash your hands of it, you have your pride. You are not about to cut corners with your code. After all, other web designers might look at it and judge you. You work damn hard, putting in more work than you probably should do. John even manages to slip in some extra functionality at the scoping stage, which turns out to be a pain in the arse. John, on the other hand, is wondering what's going on. He hasn't heard from you in weeks. Surely the site must be ready now. He decides to drop you an email asking how things are progressing. You reply with a short email saying everything is progressing nicely. After all, you never did like project management and you're sure that John would prefer you to be building his site rather than writing him detailed emails. John receives your email and finds himself becoming increasingly frustrated. What does progressing nicely mean? He writes back asking for an expected completion date and you reply with a rough estimate. The date comes and goes without a word from you. After all, it was only an estimate and several complications have delayed things by a few days. John finally loses his temper and calls you. He has arranged a marketing campaign to coincide with the launch date and because he hasn't heard from you, he's presumed everything was on schedule. You try to defend yourself against John by citing the scope creep and unexpected difficulties. However, it's hard to respond to John when he says, "All I needed was a weekly email, keeping me up to date on progress." By this stage, the relationship has broken down entirely. You finish the work and the site finally launches. Begrudgingly, John pays the invoice after delaying it for as long as he possibly could. What amazes you the most is that John says he's bitterly disappointed with the final result. How can he be so disappointed when you've given him exactly what he asked for? This guy isn't just stupid, he's also a jerk. Of course, John sees things very differently. He came to you with a list of business objectives he wanted to achieve and the site fails to achieve any of them. He hoped that he could launch the website, see it, meet its objectives and move on to the next project. Instead, after an initial spike in interest, the number of users and inquiries fell over time and the site stagnated. What John did not realize is the site needs continual love and support. He cannot build it and then abandon it. John needed to nurture his website by adding new content, engaging with his visitors, and having an ongoing plan for development. If only somebody had told him. So what's the moral of the story? Well, the moral of the story is it's amazing how quick we are to judge our clients and call them stupid. As web designers, we communicate and empathize for a living. It's our job to communicate a message to our clients' users. That's what we do for a living. We create usable sites by putting ourselves in the position of the visitors. This allows us to design around their needs. Why then do we seem incapable of either empathizing or communicating with our clients? Perhaps it's time we put these skills that we have grown as web designers to use by applying them to our own customers.
What a lovely story, Paul.
It's quite a good story. What do you think? Seriously, because I mean, probably not, it doesn't work as well in a podcast, but I was just trying different ways of writing articles and I thought that was quite interesting.
Yeah.
It was boring, wasn't it? You didn't
like
it.
No. It was good. I mean, I don't think that we suffer from that, but I did have a look at some of the comments on the blog from this post.
Yeah.
And I was amazed at the amount of people who, you know, designers and developers who were basically sort of like, yeah, this is me. I just hide myself away. I can't talk to people. I've actually stopped doing freelance work because I have to go back. And now I'm working for an agency again because I can't talk to people. So, I mean, we've talked about this in the past. The bottom line here is communicate and communicate well. But sadly, some people can't.
It's actually slightly more, or what I was getting at is slightly more than that. Communication was definitely a part of it, but the other part was empathizing, actually putting yourself in the client's position and think, what are they thinking there? Why are they doing that? Rather than just getting stroppy because they're not doing what you want them to do.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose, you could look at that as, when I said communication, I meant two-way, both ways.
Absolutely, yeah.
They need to tell you what they want, because sometimes they're not very good at that either.
But then that's for us to draw them out, out of them. So it's an interesting subject. I just thought,
I mean, it does seem to be, this is a current trend. It's kind of like, you know, let's stop picking clients apart for their apparent dumbness and let's be a bit more empathetic. Because
do you think it's a trend? I think it's the opposite. I read, there are so many articles out there that are, I mean, you joked about a session you're going to South by Southwest. What was that very first session called?
Oh, I can't remember.
It was something about...
Dealing with bastards. That could be, you know, anyone. That could be your suppliers. It doesn't necessarily be a client, does it?
But there are so many of these articles out, how to deal with difficult clients. And
I know what it was. I want to say, trend. It's. I noticed Kenneth Bowles commented, because there was the recent cartoon one when the guy's done, you know, the designer's done this wonderful design. It's quite amusing, you know, about sort of how it changes and ends up with this sort of like...
hideous monster.
Yeah, 1998 sort of a horrible monster thing. And it was a blog post he wrote, was basically, I'm bored of this.
Yeah, I am.
It's just sort of
which
like,
is what made me write this. Yeah. It's that, no, enough of that, you know, the reason you end up with a horrible 1998 website is because you as a web designer are not doing your job in communicating and empathizing with your clients.
Mm-hmm.
It pisses me off, basically, because, you know, people are only doing half their job, in my opinion. Mm. And I'm not saying there aren't difficult clients out there. There are. We've had difficult clients.
Oh, yes.
But they're fewer and far between than you kind of think. So, I mean, some people you get the impression it's like every other client.
Yeah.
And there are, you know, all these agencies that are saying, I know we're doing it slightly, but we're going to move across to building products so we don't have to deal with clients. You know, there's something wrong there.
And
you
get thousands of clients instead of a few.
Yeah, exactly. You multiply your problems manyfold.
I think you knocked it on the head when you said that people design for themselves, and it's really hard to actually take on board what the clients, you know, we get, we're going to make a usable website. But there's still always this, well, I want it to look good from my point of view.
Yeah.
And it's a really hard thing not to do that.
Yeah.
Of course, you don't want something to look bad. But there's,
are you talking about the client wanting it?
No.
Right,
the
us,
designer. Yeah. Designers think to themselves, you know, I don't want to design a site that, you know, might get ridiculed, for example.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, who knows, a sort of black and white page with just text on it might be the absolute perfect...
Absolutely.
You know, the perfect solution for that particular client. But no designer would ever do that.
No.
Is what I'm saying.
Yeah, which, is a good point. And interestingly, there's also this argument... Web designers throw around it. I'll talk about this, actually, in my South by Southwest talk coming up in Ballroom A at 9:30 on Saturday morning. Please come.
Well, I might get out of bed. Who knows?
I'll be all there by myself.
I've always had the worst hangover of the lot after that night because you've been through the sort of... You've travelled through, and then Friday's like, way! And then everyone goes out and gets lashed, and Saturday morning it's like, oh, God.
Anyway, the point that I raise in that is there's a thing within the web design community that are kind of trying to ostracise the client from the process of designing their own website. It's almost like they're trying to remove them because they'll only mess it up and screw it up. But actually, I think it's very valid that the client has to like this site at the end of it. It's not, everybody goes, oh, well, it's about the users. No, it is about the users, but it is also about the client. Mm. The client has to like the site, because if the client doesn't like the site, they won't promote the site, they won't maintain the site.
Yep.
So, you know, so the client is an intrinsic part of this process. Anyway, I could... Come and if you want to hear me rant, you can come to my talk.
Yeah.
But anyway, shall we move on to our review? Okay, so we actually have a couple of reviews today. The first is for a book called Noded, which is all about freelancing, basically. But I'll let James explain that when you listen to his review. And then we're going to run straight on from his review into a second one by Nora Brown, which is about a tool called Support Details that is worth checking out.
Noded V2. Do you know what a Noded team is? The entire book, all 86 pages of it, attempts to explain what Noded is and how Noded can be used. I found the first few chapters in which it explains what Noded is using definitions a little hard to take in, having to read a few pages again and again to grasp it. With what Noded was vaguely drilled into my head, continuing on, the book focuses on subjects very closely related to freelancing, with tips and advice on many matters such as setting up a business, planning things, to managing time. This was of huge interest to me, and the book became slightly easier to read. Throughout the book, the authors Andreas and Jan describe their methods, giving some great advice and tips on these subjects. One section I did enjoy reading was A Space to Work. It explains how important it is to find the right place to work. As a web worker, you can work from any place you fancy, a library, coffee shop, or park bench. Most of the time, however, it's nice to have a more personal place to work from. I'm under the same opinion as Andreas and Jan, having experienced this for real within the different environments and locations I have worked. Two quotes from the book which sum this up. Crappy office, crappy output. Inspiring office, nice quality output. Another section I enjoyed reading was The Tools for the Game and why you should use the cloud over your hard drive, with explanations how applications force you to use their logic and structure and therefore become really tiresome, and in the end the application is abandoned or not used to its full potential. Instead, the book suggests using cloud-based web apps that are far more flexible and forgiving. Examples include email, calendars, getting things done systems, project management, syncing files, and RSS feeds. On a more of a back-office subject, the book explains why working an 8-hour day is dead, through to tips on how to break away from the traditional meeting. I take the same approach as the book. My ideas and creativity cannot materialise on command. They come at the most inconvenient times, especially when I'm not working, such as in the shower, out on a ride on my road bike, or whilst walking my dog Tegan. The book suggests the following, as an example to break away from the traditional meeting. Use a tool such as a web app to allow people to contribute in advance of a meeting, then follow up with a simple 15-minute meeting to make a decision on the project or simply brief everyone involved. An idea from the book that I'm looking forward to trialling out in real life, the 8-hour workday is dead. A quote from the book, we don't believe that being at work for 8 hours accomplishes more than working for 4 hours, 2 hours, or 5 minutes. Work is about accomplishments, not measuring time. It is about being effective versus being efficient, doing your job faster and better versus simply doing more. Not sure how I'm going to approach my manager on this one, though, but the book does include some great examples to explain this. When you buy a music track that you really like, does it matter whether the artist spent 2 hours or 2 months writing this song? Probably not. Does a bowl of pasta taste better if the chef spent more time on it than if he spent the right amount of time on it? Probably not. In short, the book has really given me some great tips and methods as to how I should approach my freelance work, and also provided me with some great ideas how to handle projects and work within the organisation I work in. I found myself wanting to know more about some of the things that had been written within the book, so instead of getting distracted whilst reading, I created a list of pages with the references and URLs I wanted to know more about. I asked a question before reviewing the book: do you know what an ODID team is? If you answered at all, I suggest grabbing a copy of this book and truly discovering what ODID is all about. If you didn't, I still suggest reading ODID if you're at all interested in the web and making a go of it. Here is a dictionary definition of what ODID is that is included in the book. ODID network, an ODID team, a group of individuals, often but not necessarily geographically far apart, that come together to form temporary or reoccurring project teams. Unlike distributed teams, ODID teams work for a wide range of clients, and any member of an ODID team can take the lead to bring work in, manage work, and choose their members. Thanks, Paul, Ryan, and the team. I hope you all have enjoyed listening to this review of ODID V2 by James Callahan.
Hi, Paul and Marcus. My name is Nora Brown, and I wanted to let you and BOEG World listeners know about a really handy site I've come across. I'm a freelance web designer who does a lot of sites for writers, artists, small business owners, not necessarily the most tech-savvy folks. Sometimes they don't even know that they're using a browser, much less that what specific version of IE they might be using. So to help diagnose problems, I direct them to www.supportdetails.com. From this website, they can simply email me, and it sends me all the details of their browsing environment. You can even give a link with your email address pre-filled in. And as an added bonus, it includes their IP address, so you can create a filter in Google Analytics to exclude their own site visits from their stats. So again, that's supportdetails.com. I hope you find it useful.
So thank you very much to both James and Nora for doing those reviews. Really interesting stuff. Support Details is just a superb idea. I think I will be making use of with some of our clients in the future. And ODID, interesting idea, interesting book, and I think is becoming increasingly relevant in the new model of how many web designers are working. Okay, so that pretty much wraps up this week's show, except for Marcus's painful. Oh, do you know what? We've forgotten. I've got that audio, that joke. We need to play that joke at some point.
Next week. I've got quite a good one here, okay. Even though it does use the word penis.
I'll have to remove our clean tag.
That's all right. That's a medical term.
It's a medical term. Yes. Okay.
It's a knob gag. But here we go.
Knob isn't a medical term.
No, but there we go. Anyway, a man wakes up in the hospital bandaged from head to foot. This is from Ian Lasky, by the way. Haven't an Ian joke for a while. The doctor comes in and says, "Ah, I see you've regained consciousness. Now, you probably won't remember, but you were in a huge pile-up on the motorway. You're going to be okay, you'll walk again and everything, but your penis was severed in the accident and we couldn't find it."
Oh, Ian, don't encourage him.
The man groans, but the doctor goes on, "You've got £9,000 in insurance. Insurance compensation coming, and we now have the technology to build a new one. They work great, but they don't come cheap. It's roughly £1,000 an inch." The man perks up. "So," the doctor says, "you must decide how many inches you want, but this is something you should definitely discuss with your wife. Because, you know, you don't want to disappoint her or whatever." I'm not going to go into that bit.
Too much detail.
Too much detail. So the man agrees to talk it over with his wife.
Right. I don't... This is a bad
choice.
The
doctor comes back the next day. "So, have you spoken with your wife?" "Yes, I have," says the man. "And did she help you make the decision?" "Yes," says the man. "So what's your decision?" asks the doctor. "We're getting granite worktops." Which I thought was quite good. You didn't know where that was going. You were worried, weren't you?
I was, the whole way through. And the laugh at the end was out of nervousness. Kind of nervous relief, really. Okay, phew, made it through that. And we've survived the 201st episode of BoagWorld.com. Please join us again. We promise the quality will improve as we recover. The podcast for all those involved in designing, developing and running websites on a daily basis.
Bye.